You only have one life. The word of the Lord comes to us from the book of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 8. Also, I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? And who will go for us? Then I said, here am I. Send me. This is the word of God. Dr. David Livingston is an example of excellence. His life, his legacy, his literature continue to speak to us today. The challenge of David Livingston is most relevant to our times. If Dr. David Livingston was here today, what do you think he may say to us? We do not need to guess. We have his writings. We have his published statements available. We can know exactly what David Livingston would say to us today. It's what he said to the people of his generation. The salvation of men ought to be the chief desire and aim of every Christian. All men have the right to hear God's word. No nation ought to hoard the gospel like a miser. Can the love of Christ not carry the missionary where the slave trade carries the slave trader? If you have men who will come only if they know that there's a good road, I don't want them. I want men who will come even if there's no road at all. Amen. We must be uncommon Christians. This is a letter he wrote to his sisters. We must be uncommon Christians. That is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. Let us seek that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified, that holiness to the Lord may be engraved on the heart and ever more characterize our whole conduct. We have still a debt of gratitude to Jesus, and there's no greater privilege on earth than after having our own chains broken off to go forth, to proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of prison to them which are bound. That's a quote from one letter he wrote to his sisters. Do you write letters like that to your siblings? Dr. David Livingston was inspired by an optimistic view of the future. Like most of the missionaries of the greatest century of missions, the 19th century, Livingston held to an eschatology of victory. Discoveries and inventions are cumulative, filling the earth with the glory of the Lord. All nations will sing his glory and will bow before him. Our work and its fruits are cumulative. We work towards a new state of things. Future missionaries will be rewarded by conversions for every sermon. We are their pioneers and helpers. Let them not forget the watchman of the night who worked when all was gloom and no evidence of success in the way of conversions cheers out of. They will doubtless have more light than we. But we serve our master earnestly, and we proclaim the same gospel they will do. A quiet audience today, he wrote in his journal, the seed is being sown, the least of all seeds now, but it will grow into a mighty tree. It is, as it were, a small stone cut out of the mountain, but it will fill the whole earth. We work for a glorious future, which we are not destined to see. The golden age, which has not yet been, but will yet be. We are only morning stars, shining in the dark. But the glorious morn will break. The good time is coming yet. The dominion has been given by the power of commerce and population unto the people of the saints of the Most High. This is an everlasting kingdom. A little stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which will cover the whole earth. For this time we work by different agencies. The great ruler is gathering all things into a focus. Jesus is gathering all things to himself, and he is daily becoming more and more the center of the world's hopes and of the world's fears. When David Livingston first came to Africa, there were 5 million Christians in the whole continent, most of those in Ethiopia and Egypt. Today, there are over 500 million people in Africa who claim to be Christians, according to Operation World. This includes 150 million Protestants, 50 million Anglicans, 140 million Charismatics, 60 million Pentecostals, and 100 million Independents. Not a bad harvest. Especially when people keep criticizing the missionaries. Well, I must have done something right. Africa has the fastest growing church in the world. David Livingstone plowed in rocky, stony, thorny ground. He sowed the gospel seed that has produced this great harvest. He was the first messenger of the gospel in many countries. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nation shall worship before you, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. The life and legacy of David Livingstone changed my life. As a new Christian, converted 3rd of April 1977, I imbibed many of the presuppositions and tendencies of churches of the 1970s. I read The Late Great Planet Earth, There's a New World Coming, Satan is Alive and Well on Planet Earth, and other date-setting end times rapture fever publications. We showed the films Like a Thief in the Night, A Distant Thunder, and other hysterical date-setting 1970s specials. I was saved. I loved the Lord. I was enthusiastically involved in evangelism, but my understanding of biblical doctrine was actually quite shallow. I imbibed the prevailing prejudice against Calvinism, and I was convinced we were living in the last days. Therefore, I could not at the time consider marriage or children. There just wasn't enough time. The Lord is coming before the end of the year and the next, and so on. I could not allow myself to be distracted by such worldly matters as family and raising children. I needed to devote my last few days on earth to snatching souls from the fire. The rapture was coming, surely before the end of 1977. 78, 79, and 80, and 81. I was completely closed to the idea of theological training. What's the point? The Lord will have come before I could finish my studies. Better to stay in the field winning souls in these last few days remaining. Then I read The Puritan Hope, Revival and Interpretation of Prophecy by Ian Murray, published by Banner of Truth. I must say, Banner of Truth produces a treasure house of good books. This book informed me that all of the pioneer missionaries of the 19th century missionary movement were Calvinist and post-millennial. Now, I had no idea what post-millennialism was, but when I read that the father of modern missions, William Carey, and the best friend Africa ever had, Dr. David Livingstone, that they were both reformed and both post-millennial, I determined to read up more on these matters. Earlier, I'd read a thin modern biography on David Livingstone. It didn't seem too extraordinary because, like most modern books, it's been sanitized. There's a narrative you've got to stick to. All controversial or politically correct details have been omitted. The modern censored version of Livingstone's life did not mention the ravages of the Islamic slave trade, which David Livingstone confronted, documented, and fought against. It left out his Calvinist convictions, his post-millennial eschatology of victory, which inspired so much of his work. The modern biographies left out the fact that David Livingstone arrived in Africa in 1841 with a six-barreled revolver and a double-barreled rifle. Pretty advanced weaponry for 1841. His violent confrontations with Islamic slave traders, his bold initiatives to set thousands of captives free were also deemed, apparently, too controversial to include in modern, sanitized, abridged versions of Livingstone's life. We've got a dumbed-down church with dumbed-down history and dumbed-down vocabulary and dumbed-down choruses, 7-11s, seven words sung 11 times over, no content, no reflection, no history, shallow, superficial, me, myself, and I, dumbed-down for us. No wonder the church is so ineffective. We've lost a heritage and a history and don't even know what happened before we were born. However, I've always been something of a bookworm. I have a love for history. And finding most of the books available in the average bookshop today, including Christian bookshops, very shallow and predictable. I've developed a preference for scouring through second-hand bookshops, finding rare old first editions of these missionaries and pioneers. I was reading Livingstone's travels as I was following in much of his footsteps in the Tete province of Mozambique in the Zambezi Valley, 1989. That was when I and the medical mission team I was leading were captured by Russian forces, imprisoned in SNASP security prison in Mashava, Maputo. What I learned from the writings and from the exemplary life and extraordinary legacy of David Livingstone transformed my life and my ministry. So what did I learn from David Livingstone? I learned from David Livingstone the importance of discipline. He was disciplined in reading. He was disciplined in exercise. He was self-controlled. Livingstone abstained from alcohol for life. He was temperate. He was duty-oriented. He was hard-working. Livingstone's work ethic is a rebuke to us all. From age 10, he worked 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, walking an average of 34 kilometers a day in the factory, much of this in a crawling or stooping position amongst or under the machinery or balanced over it. He was a piecer. He was in the cotton mills. Whenever the cotton broke, he had to get there and had to re-piece it quickly, or he'd get whipped, literally, by the supervisors to keep them rolling the whole time. Imagine the tremendous physical training this was for his later transcontinental expeditions across Africa. Walking 34 kilometers a day, every day, 6 days a week, for 12 years. This he did in esteemed heat and humidity considered essential for the production of thread. David used his first week's wages. Now he is 10 years old. His first week's wages he used to buy rudiments of Latin. Less than 10% of the children who worked in the cotton mills ever learned to read or write. David Livingstone not only learned to read and write, he taught himself Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. Every night after work, he had attended night school from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Then at home, he had study off until midnight. Every morning began at 5:30 as the bell rang, and his work day at 6 at the cotton mill. From 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., working at the cotton mill, studying after hours. Now, I should say something about his life before he started his work life at age 10. He is about 8 years old. He is reading on the banks of the Clyde River, and he heard a scream, and he looked up, and he saw a little girl who was playing a game with her little toddler brother, and they were in a little boat, and she lost the oars, and the boat was being sucked in inexorably towards the paddle wheels of the cotton mill. And of course, the boat would be crushed, and the little girl and her brother would be crushed to death, inevitably. He didn't hesitate. He plunged into icy waters. He rescued both the little girl and boy before the boat got sucked and got destroyed, and took them to home. And he never said a word about it the rest of his life. And the only reason we know about this is the father of David Livingstone was asked to provide a testimonial to his son for the London Missionary Society. And in the London Missionary Society archives is this letter from his father that mentioned how the parents of this little girl and little boy came round to the home to thank them and to inform them. He didn't even tell his parents what he had done. He just rescued them, went back to his book. That was David Livingstone. When he was studying medicine and theology, he would walk from Blantyre to Glasgow, 8 miles, refusing every offer of a ride by horse carts passing by, because he preferred the four-hour walk, often in the snow, in order to strengthen his muscles for his chosen career in missions. David Livingstone never accepted charity. Although brought up in the poorest of circumstances, where his family of seven, two parents, five children, lived in this room, 10 feet by 14 feet, that's the entire room. That's their whole house. There's no other facilities. No electricity, no plumbing, no running water. All seven of the family lived in this room, which is today a museum. He worked, he saved, to put himself through both medical school and theological college. By the way, I've read in dumb modern biographies that David Livingstone was given a bursary to study at college. There were no bursaries or anything like that in the 1830s. And he wouldn't have accepted it anyway. But you've got these imbeciles today who think, oh, because we live on welfare, everyone in history had to have, and because other people today get things given to them free, that must be... David Livingstone never accepted charity. He worked to put himself through theological college and medical school. He was the first worker for the cotton mills ever to receive a university education. And nobody gave it to him. He earned it. He passed it with high honors. He received his doctorate from the Royal Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons, November 1840. He was ordained as a congregational minister 20th of November 1840. His parents were too poor to attend his ordination service. It required too much travel. Against all odds, David Livingstone achieved far more than anyone would have thought humanly possible for someone born into such a poverty-stricken, disadvantaged background. 26 families lived in this block here. His family had one on the top floor. Today it's a museum. You see this mill, this is for the mill workers here. They've got one water pump in the yard. His brother and him many a time went every drop of water they needed for washing, cooking, cleaning, drinking, had to be carried in buckets up those circular stairs to their room on the top floor. So he wore a path to this water pump. David Livingstone did not wait for someone else to open up Africa for the gospel. He didn't wait for someone to invent a four-wheel drive vehicle. He didn't wait for somebody to build some bridges and roads. He drew the first maps of the Zambezi. He did not have an attitude of entitlement, which is the curse of our age. David Livingstone had a Protestant work ethic. By the way, these are some of the pathetic maps of Africa that existed over history. Talk about the dark continent. The geographers didn't have a clue. They really were absolutely clueless as to what Africa was like. Now, you notice here, the Nile River is meant to come right into what today would be South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe. If you go to the Kruger National Park, they will tell you this is the Nile crocodile. Now, this crocodile's got nothing to do with the Nile. But because of the belief of people at the time that the Nile came all the way down to South Africa, it was assumed that the crocodiles they saw in South Africa were Nile crocodiles. So that's why they got the name the Nile crocodile. As late as 16th century, they've got the mountains of the moon positioned in basically Malawi, Mozambique, and South Africa, and Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. And so you can see really, really, really inaccurate maps. When David Livingstone came to Africa, most of the map was blank or had unexplored territory or unknown. It was generally believed by the geographers and scientists at the time that the middle of Africa was one big colossal desert. David Livingstone filled in the map. He showed the center of Africa is full of rivers and lakes and waterfalls and plateaus and mountains, and he filled in the blank parts of the center of Africa. He drew the first map of the Zambezi, and if you compare our satellite maps today with Livingstone's map, which he drew of the Zambezi River following the entire plot of it, his are accurate. You can't improve on it much. He did this with sextants, with the stars, and boiling with his, when he was boiling his water for tea, he'd have a thermometer in, notice exactly the degrees that it boiled at, work out the elevation, the altitude, and so on. David Livingstone was an extraordinary explorer, and going down the Zambezi River, he saw this phenomenal cloud of mist. I've seen it 60, 70 kilometers away. During the rainy season, it really dominates the landscape. He asked the local people, what is it? Musi Oya Tanya, the smoke that thunders. What makes the smoke thunder? Spirits. Have you been there? You're out of your mind. No. Now, I've heard people say, of course David Livingstone didn't discover Victoria Falls. Everyone knew it. Well, not necessarily. He certainly was the first to name it, measure it, and publicize and make it known. But he may have been the first to see it, actually, because the local people were so superstitious, they were so terrified by the smoke that thunders. When Livingstone got there, he discovered the greatest concentration of wildlife he saw in 26 years of walking across Africa. Why would there be a great concentration of herds of elephants and buffalo and all other animals there? Nobody went there to hunt. So it's a nature sanctuary. And that again indicates probably nobody in the area knew what was there. They were too terrified, the noise and the smoke. David Livingstone got a canoe and on his own went and hit this, what we today call Livingstone Island. And he crawled out to the edge and looked at a sight, he said, angels at creation must have wandered at such sights and gazed at such sights. Now, these two men standing with spears next to him, that's total artist imagination. There was no one there. He was there alone, but I suppose the people in Britain didn't understand all that was involved. He crawled to the edge and he let down a weight. There's Livingston Island, right there. He crawled to the edge and he let down a weighted rope measured out 310 feet high. That's Livingston Island. Crawled to the edge of that. That must have been quite phenomenal. You almost feel like you're going to fall off the edge. In fact, to crawl to the edge and let down a weighted rope and get the height accurate, we can't improve his measurements. There you can see another look at Livingston Island. This is his map that he drew. This is in his diary. And you can notice he's got 410 paces there, 150 paces there. Wide, 310 feet deep. Notice Victoria Falls is 1,860 yards wide. That's what it is. That's accurate. We can't improve on those measurements. He did this before GPS, did this before satellite imagery. He did better than that. He drew a picture, which I've got in the first editions of Livingston's Travels, imagining a height that doesn't exist. There isn't an elevation where you can look down on it like this. Before drones, before helicopters, he positioned it to be able to give not what you could see on the ground, but what you could imagine if you were sort of getting an angel's eyes view. And it's accurate. That's what Victoria Falls looks like, taken now from a helicopter. I've flown over Victoria Falls by helicopter. He did better than that. He positioned and showed you the gorges. And that's accurate. Again, there's no elevation that he could have seen this from. He sketched this. You know any artist how hard it is to sketch something with observation. But to sketch it from imagination, from a different perspective than you can even get to. This is talent. He's accurate. He got it right. On the second missionary journey, the Zambezi expedition, he was given Thomas Baines, one of the greatest artists of the Victorian era, to come. And one of Thomas Baines' instructions from Queen Victoria was to paint Victoria Falls. So this is years later, and you can see phenomenal herds of buffalo, wildlife. This is a really lush place. Again, a nature sanctuary because people weren't hunting there because the local people were too scared of the smoke that thunders, Mosio Tanya, to go there. Even to go to Victoria Falls today with all the habitation around, it's still impressive. This is very impressive. And Victoria Falls is forever associated with David Livingston because he is the one who made it known, the one who named it. Millions of tons of water pouring over every hour. If you go there in a rainy season, you can get so wet that you could jump in a Zambezi, you wouldn't get any wetter. Totally drenched just from the smoke that thunders. 1955, on the 100th anniversary of David Livingston discovering Victoria Falls, 16 November. I can never forget my wife's birthday because it's the day that David Livingston discovered Victoria Falls, 16 November. Always good to have a date you can measure things by. And the Livingston statue at Victoria Falls is very impressive. This is the iconic statue of David Livingston. To achieve what he did, Livingston was decisive, goal-orientated, inflexible. Reformed theology put doctrinal steel in his backbone. He was a man of integrity. He was a man of his word. He meant what he said, and he said what he meant. He walked many thousands of miles across difficult and dangerous terrain to return his porters to the village. Now, understand, he'd just taken 2 years to cross Africa, and he arrived at Luanda in Angola. The forerunner ship was waiting to take him to England. He could be with his family in a matter of weeks. He chose to spend another 2 years crossing Africa back again to return his porters to the village because they couldn't find it without his help, all of his scientific knowledge and observing the stars and working out the directions and drawing the maps and so on. And so he took another 2 years crossing the continent that almost killed him on his crossing to ensure that his porters were taken back to their families safely and not able to be to protect them from slave raiders en route. A man of integrity. David Livingston understood the power of prayer. He had Holy Spirit fire in his heart, soul, and mind. He prayed and he sang the Psalms daily. He had a great love for God's creation, for nature, and for wildlife. His books are filled with intricate sketches and fascinating details of animals and vegetation. impactful. These are all sketches I took from Livingstone's travels, his first book, Missionary Travels. And he introduced the strange creatures in Africa, the eland and the hippopotamus, the waterbucks, the baobab tree, from which you can make so many things. You can make sandals and rope and the different tools that people were using, the different body piercing and tattoos and ornaments that they had, the strange bangles, the strange hairstyles and the different types of beards that people would have. He showed the different musical instruments they were using, such as Nangola, and the religious superstitious activities, such as worshipping on the night of the full moon. How the Bushmen had water in the desert, how they would get hollowed out ostrich eggs and fill it with water, put tufts of straw in it, take it, bury it in the sand as water that they could come back to later. He saw in Africa filled with wildlife. He saw sights that we would not see. Even if we go to game reserves, we wouldn't see the kind of huge herds that he saw. Herds of 400 elephants at a time. Massive, incredibly dangerous animals. He walked across Africa by foot amongst the leopards and the cheetahs, the fastest animals in the world. The kings of the jungle, the lions. He was once mauled by a lion. Now, they've got a very unfair slander against lions at the Livingstone Museum in Blantyre. They've got a statue of a lion attacking Livingstone. There's no sign of his rifle. As Livingstone said, the dumbest thing he ever did was getting talked by a chief into going and hunting a lion, because this chief had said that the lion was hunting their goats, which is highly unlikely. There's so much wildlife. Lions would not go for goats, unless they don't have anything else to go for. And there was hordes of zebra and all the rest. But doubtless the chief wanted to use his ability and his rifle to get himself a lion skin. David Livingstone shot this lion who was lying on a rock minding his own business, and the lion with a bullet in him came to him, crunched his shoulder, and flung him like a rat. He describes the symptoms, how there was no pain. He said, this is interesting. This must be a gift from the Creator that animals, when they are grabbed by a lion, they feel no pain. Shock, of course, initially. And you probably have noticed this if you cut yourself or you came off your bicycle while riding onto tar, and you don't feel a pain immediately. There's a numbness. And so he describes all the details and how he recovered and so on. But he picked the fight with a lion, and to put a statue indicating a lion attack in Livingstone like he was minding his own business. He was never attacked by a lion the rest of his 26 years walking across Africa. The only time he was attacked by a lion was when he shot the lion. When he drew first blood. I'm normally on David Livingstone's side, but on this one, I'm on the lion's side. You mind your own business. I've walked past lions in the wild, and you leave them alone, you respect them, they leave you alone. Animals are not hunting people, as he saw in the rest of his life. Well, magnificent animals. By the way, you know, when missionaries reported that there's snow at the equator in Africa, they were discounted as liars. There's no way there can be snow at the equator in Africa. Missionaries lost their support, were cut off and excommunicated from the churches for reporting the truth. There's snow on the equator in Africa, even in summer. And poor Johan Krupp, for example, lost the support for this because people didn't, until cameras were able to document that actually the missionaries were telling the truth. There is snow at the equator, Mount Kilimanjaro, Mount Kenya. But he saw these things. He documented them. David Livingstone was inspired by post-millennial eschatology victory. He had a kingdom vision. You know, we preach the gospel of salvation, or I hope we do, but Jesus preached the gospel of the kingdom. Now, the gospel of the kingdom includes the gospel of salvation, but it's just a small part. The gospel of salvation is about how I can get saved. But the gospel of the kingdom is God's plan for the whole world. It includes the gospel of salvation, but it's much broader. We're not to go out and make converts. We're out to make disciples. Not just of individuals, but of nations. The Great Commission is great. David Livingstone understood the greatness of the Great Commission. He worked to comprehensively fulfill the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit. As a doctor, a medical doctor, he ministered to the body. As a teacher, he ministered to mind. As a preacher of the gospel, he ministered to the spirit. This is the stained glass window at Livingstonia in Malawi. David Livingstone, sowing the good seed. Wherever he went, he used his medical knowledge and training, his breadth of reading and learning, his deep faith and knowledge of the Holy Scriptures to enrich and empower the people of Africa. On the flyleaf of his first book, Missionary Travels and Researches in South Africa, remember, the country we call South Africa was only called that in 1910. They referred to South Africa like you'd refer to South America today. It didn't mean one country. I mean, South Africa is just an empire, actually. It's not a nation. It's 11 nations. But so when he spoke about South Africa, he's thinking of everything basically south of the equator. That was how you'd have spoken before 1910. People today still get confused that South Africa is like South America, a continent. But just, I know many people get confused because we have a country today called South Africa. He puts a tsetse fly. Now, you would have thought he might put a lion or an elephant. No, he puts a tsetse fly. And he says, this is the greatest obstacle to progress and advance in Africa. The tsetse fly kills horses. I've seen pictures of David Livingstone riding a horse at the head of his porters, carrying things in it. Total imagination and anachronistic nonsense. He didn't ride horses in Africa. He walked everywhere. And there's no way he could have ridden a horse because the horses got killed by the tsetse fly. David Livingstone was the first person to suggest that mosquitoes are responsible for malaria. The scientists of his time were convinced that malaria is caused by bad air. Malaria, bad air. That's the etymology of the word in Latin. Malaria, bad air. Solution, high roofs. I was brought up in home with high roofs in Rhodesia because they were convinced that you had to let the bad air rise because of bad air causes malaria. David Livingstone said, no, mosquitoes cause it. How can insects have anything to do with malaria? He said, it's not just mosquitoes, it's the pregnant female mosquito that causes malaria, which is why you might get stung by a mosquito, but you cannot get malaria unless you're outside of your mosquito net, which he used, and he promoted between about 11 at night and 5 in the morning. Because that's when the pregnant mosquito is going around seeking to lay her eggs, and that's what gives you malaria. Imagine the observation of a person to have put this together. And it took more than 20 years for the scientists to catch up with Livingstone and realize he is right. Mosquitoes cause malaria. He didn't just identify the cause, he identified the treatment. Here it is, quinine. Livingstone's Rouser. I remember these tablets in Rhodesia. We had to take these growing up in the Bundu, as we call it. And malaria can only be treated by quinine. Now, quinine is from a bush found in Brazil, in the Amazon. And David Livingstone, on his way out to Africa, providentially, his ship lost the foremast, had to put in at Rio de Janeiro, and while they were fixing the ship's mast, in other words, going into the jungle to find one to a nice tree to chop down and turn to a mast. He did outreach and so on, but he also wandered around the forests, the Amazon jungle, and he found clippings of different types of bushes, and he kept a whole lot of seedlings, and he planted them at his mission station, Kuruman, and he tried and tested, and he discovered quinine from Brazil, which he'd all documented these things. That was the treatment to survive malaria. Hence, he is able to survive 26 years in the field, having malaria countless times, probably about 60 times, because he had the treatment. Now, the average white missionary to Africa, West Africa, they were dying within 2 years. Some died within 3 months of arrival. He survived because he identified the cause and he identified the treatment and also the prevention in the way of mosquito nets. He's a scientist, remember, as well. David Livingstone teaches us that actions speak louder than words. He was described as a man of resolute courage. Fire, water, stone wall would not stop Livingstone in the fulfillment of any recognized duty. Indeed, he did not let swamps, rivers, deserts, or mountains prevent him from opening up Africa for the gospel. David Livingstone was determined to make a difference. The Great Commission was his supreme ambition. Christ's last command was his first concern. He wrote, I hope to be permitted to work as long as I live beyond other men's line of things, and to plant the seed of the gospel where others have not planted. I am a missionary, heart and soul. God had an only son, and he was a missionary and a physician. A poor, poor imitation of him I am or wish to be. In his service, I hope to live. In it, I wish to die. I shall open up a path into the interior or perish. May God bless us and make us blessings even unto death. Shame upon us missionaries if we to be outdone by slave traders. Battling rains, chronic discomfort, rust, mildew and rot. Totally drenched, fatigued, laid low by fever countless times. Livingston continued to persevere across the continent. Trials tested the tenacity of the travel-weary team. Often Livingston endured excessive, unnecessary suffering and deprivation, hacking through dense jungle on foot because lack of funds prevented him from affording the luxury of a canoe. I would not have thought a canoe was a luxury when you're mapping the Zambezi River. These privations, I beg you to observe, are not sacrifices. I think that word ought never to be mentioned in reference to anything we can do for him. Who, though he is rich, yet for our sakes he became poor. The challenge of Livingston rings out to us today. Can that be called a sacrifice, which is simply paid back as a small part of a great debt owing to our God, which we can never repay? It is emphatically no sacrifice. Say rather, it is a privilege. David Livingston emphasized that sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We need to put feet to our faith. Livingston also alerted the world to the cancerous sore of the Islamic slave trade. It was missionary pioneer David Livingston whose graphic descriptions brought the ravages of the East African slave trade to light. His missionary travels, his narrative of an expedition to the Zambezi, exposed the horrors of the slave trade. Two of the women had been shot the day before for attempting to untie their tongues. One woman had her infant's brains knocked out because she could not carry her load and the baby. A man was dispatched with an axe because he had broken down with fatigue. Those taken out of the country are but a very small section of the sufferers. We never realized the atrocious nature of the traffic until we sat and saw it at the fountainhead. There truly Satan has a seat. Besides those actually captured, thousands are killed and die of their wounds and famine, driven from their villages by the war waged for slaves with their own clansmen and neighbors, slain by the lust of gain, which is stimulated, be it remembered, always by the slave purchases of Cuba and elsewhere. David Livingston taught you cannot be neutral in the battlefields of life. He had the courage to confront evil. His fearless faith fought the good fight of faith, and he set many thousands of captives free. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. David Livingston is an example of extraordinary patience and perseverance. He overcame every obstacle. He walked across the continent of Africa. He walked from Delgo Bay, present-day Port Elizabeth, all the way through Kraaifontein, which he called the prettiest town in Africa, where he stayed at the Andrew Murray home, to Kuruman, where Robert Moffat had his mission station in Northern Cape. He walked across what is today Botswana, all the way back across to the Cape Colony, to Cape Town, to place his family on a ship to return to Britain. He then walked from Cape Town across the whole of the Cape Province, across what today is Botswana, Zambia, and Angola, to the port of Luanda. He then walked from the Atlantic Ocean all across the continent of Africa, across what is today Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique, to the Indian Ocean. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Here you can see his, again, a fold-out chart in his missionary travels book, which I've got a first edition of. And he's worked out the cross-section of the continent, describing the different terrain, the plateaus, the altitude. He came back and he explored much of the Zambezi River, the Shiri River, the Rovuma River, walking across much of what is today Mozambique, Malawi, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe. Yet in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. On his third great missionary journey, he walked across the whole length of Tanzania, much of Mozambique and Malawi, Zambia and the Congo and Burundi. He finally died on his knees in prayer in the province of Luapula in northern Zambia. In his 30 years of dedicated missionary service in Africa, he walked from coast to coast across what are today 12 vast countries. He walked across a country and a continent that did not have any roads, any bridges, or any purified water. I shall try to hold myself in readiness to go anywhere, provided it be forward. David Livingston teaches us the power of the printed page. It was the books he read, such as Practical Christianity, written by William Wilberforce, which he read at age 12, which channeled much of his life in dedicated labors to eradicate the slave trade and open up Africa for the gospel. Livingstone wrote missionary travels, the Zambezi expedition, and his journals, which inspired generations of missionaries to dedicate their lives to winning Africa for Christ. It was Livingstone's steadfast example that inspired Mary Slessor to devote her life to Calabar, present-day Nigeria. Her two brothers had died ahead of her, who were planning to go into Africa as missionaries to Calabar. And so she determined to take their place when she heard that David Livingstone had died. And she was, in fact, the first single woman missionary to go alone into unexplored territory and minister there. Peter Cameron launched the Africa Inland Mission, but not until he had come back from Africa in failure. But then he went to Westminster Abbey and he saw the inscription on the tomb of David Livingstone. "Other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice." Cameron was rebuked, inspired, and resolved to return to Africa. And today, if you go to East Africa, the Africa Inland Church is one of the biggest churches, and that's a result of Peter Cameron's mission, Africa Inland Mission. If you go to Westminster Abbey, and some of you have probably seen the wedding of William and Catherine, for example, you'll notice that they must walk past the tomb of David Livingstone, which is in the central place in Westminster Abbey, to get to the high altar. Livingstone knew the power of the printed page and of public speaking tours. He also focused on universities as strategic for mobilizing missionaries and reformers to fulfill the Great Commission. Livingstone saw rivers not as obstacles, but as God's highway to reach Africa for Christ. All communities need access to water, so rivers are a strategic artery which missionaries should utilize to fulfill the Great Commission. David Livingstone believed in leadership training. His vision was to establish Bible colleges to train Africans as evangelists, teachers, and missionaries to disciple the nations. His mission board ruled that out, said that's not possible. But he has a vision. He saw the way ahead. His life and legacy taught me the importance of discipline, exercise, reading, a Christian work ethic, temperance, self-control, self-denial, and to be duty-orientated. His Reformation theology has put doctrinal steel in my backbone. He has taught me the importance of being a man of my word, a person of integrity, but most important, a student of God's word. The post-millennial eschatology victory of David Livingstone has inspired me that we are not working at uncertainty. The Lord, who gave us the Great Commission, will ensure that it is fulfilled. His promises and his power are fully sufficient to empower his church to fulfill his Great Commission, making disciples of all nations and teaching obedience to all things that the Lord has commanded. David Livingstone's comprehensive vision of fulfilling the Great Commission, ministering to body, mind, and spirit, has raised the standards for missionary service for all of us. It's a rebuke to religious tourism. Actions speak louder than words. Sacrificial service is more powerful than eloquent sermons. We must put feet to our faith. We must recognize that we are in a world war of worldviews. And this picture, by the way, reminds one of an interesting episode in David Livingstone's career. He was well read in everything from zoology, botany, through to geology. And being around Kuruman, which isn't far from Kimberley, he picked up diamonds. Talking about the 1840s. He threw them in the bush, said nothing about it. Later in his life, as Henry Morton Stanley was heading towards the greatest journalistic coup of the century, when he found the explorer that had disappeared and no one had heard from him for years. In fact, the word had gone out, David Livingstone is dead, he died years ago. They even blamed the Zulus. They said the Zulus had killed David Livingstone near Lake Nasser, Malawi. But Stanley was convinced he was still alive, and he tracked him down. He found him on the Lake Tanzania, Lake Tanganyika, which is basically the middle of the continent. And so there's only two white men, all of equatorial Africa, from the Zambezi to the Nile, met. Henry Morton Stanley walked deliberately towards the older man, took off his hat and said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." Livingstone responded, "Yes." Stanley lifted his cap slightly, and they shook hands. "I thank God, doctor, I've been permitted to see you," he said. Livingstone replied, "I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you." And Stanley immediately offered Livingstone a packet of letters from his family and friends at home, expecting him to read them immediately. But he put them to one side and said, "As I've waited years for letters, I've been taught patience. I can afford to wait a few hours more. Tell me the general news. How's the world getting on?" He'd asked the right person, a journalist. "Suez Canal's just been opened. General Grant is now president of the United States. The Pacific Railroad across the continent of America has been completed. Prussia has defeated Denmark and France in war. France meant to be the superpower, new power rising in Prussia, what now is Germany. The first transatlantic cable had been laid, permitting intermediate communication between North America and Europe, and diamonds have been discovered in South Africa." And he says, "I wondered how long that would take. And yes, it was near Kuruman. They've named the place Kimberley." Livingstone related his experience of finding those diamonds walking around. And of course, Stanley once said, "Why didn't you sell these diamonds?" He said, "Oh, I couldn't do that. If I had done that, we would have had prospectors come from around the world, vice coming into the area. We were trying to bring the gospel to the Tswana. We had a lot of work to do. It would have destroyed the Tswana people to be corrupted by the vice that would come with the mines." And therefore, he had found the pearl of great price. He wasn't going to get sidetracked by diamonds. "Could you not have taken the diamonds back to Scotland and sold them during one of your furloughs?" He said, "The people knew where I worked. They would have torn the place apart to find these diamonds. These were the best diamonds the world had ever seen." So David Livingstone literally took diamonds and threw them aside. He wasn't going to get distracted from the Great Commission by diamonds. How's that for focus? The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Islam is a threat to faith and freedom. You cannot be neutral. Confront evil. Fight the good fight of faith. Be bold. Be brave. Be courageous. Be patient. Be steadfast. Persevere. Overcome every obstacle. Obstacles are only there to be overcome. Go forward in the faith. Never forget the power of the printed page. Invest in books. Invest in your mind. Read. Teach your people to love reading. Readers make leaders. A reading Christian is a growing Christian. Do not forget the schools, the colleges, and the universities. They are strategic. We must disciple the next generation to be faithful to God's word and effective in God's service. Think strategically as to how we can reach nations for Christ. Make your life count for eternity. We've got a livingstonefellowship.co.za website where we put a lot of articles, Bible studies and sermons, audio, video, and in different languages. We have a Livingstone 200 website we set up after our whole Livingstone 200 on the 20th anniversary of David Livingstone's birth in 2013. We had a 12-country mission Africa overland for Livingstone 200, going to many of the places we had first pioneered the work, and we concluded at Victoria Falls 16 November with Mayor's office and others in and national TV, national radio of Zambia in attendance. They recognized how important it was. If you go to our mission house, Livingstone House, you'll see we have a plaque with a whole lot of postage stamps produced by the Zambian government to commemorate Livingstone 200. We have a Dr. David Livingstone Facebook page, dr.davidlivingstone, and you'll see a lot of interesting things there. For those doing the Great Commission course, you'll see our mission headquarters is called Livingstone House. In the words of C.T. Studd, "You only have one life. It'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last." As William Carey declared, "Expect great things from God. Attempt great things for God. God is great. Honor him with great faith." So what would David Livingstone say to us today? "I beg to direct your attention to Africa. I know that in a few years I shall be cut off from that country which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. Will you carry out the work I've begun? I leave it with you." Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I, Lord. Send me."